Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 9th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing shows three Republicans standing side by side with kind of the see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil pose. I know one of them's Mitch McConnell and one of them's Devin Nunes, but I don't know the third one. Behind them in the background is a huge and fierce-looking, growling Russian bear. The title says, Seeing No Evil. Why is the GOP blocking efforts to protect the 2020 election from Russian interference? And indeed, that is our first main story. The GOP skepticism on election interference. What happened? President Trump this week tapped a skeptic of the Russia investigation to become the director of national intelligence and renewed warnings that the Kremlin is working to sabotage the country's vulnerable electoral infrastructure. Trump nominated Representative John Ratcliffe of Texas to oversee the nation's network of 17 spy agencies, forcing out Dan Coats. As DNI, Coats frequently undercut the president's attempts to downplay Russian meddling, defending the intelligence community's conclusion that Moscow sought to tilt the 2016 election to Trump. Ratcliffe has signed on to the Republican theory it was actually Hillary Clinton's campaign that conspired with Russia as a way to discredit Trump. He received the nomination just days after impressing Trump by attacking special counsel Robert Mueller for stating that Trump hadn't been exonerated of a crime. We need somebody strong that can really rein it in, Trump said of Ratcliffe, because as I think you've all learned, the intelligence agencies have run amok. They've run amok. Ratcliffe, however, faces an uphill confirmation battle with some GOP senators skeptical about his lack of national security experience. Senator Richard Burr, head of the Intelligence Committee, called him too political. Burr's committee revealed last week that Russian hackers probed election systems in all 50 states in 2016, perhaps finding vulnerabilities to exploit in 2020. Nevertheless, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked votes on several election security bills passed by Democrats in the House of Representatives, prompting a storm of criticism with hashtag Moscow Mitch trending on Twitter. On the Senate floor, an angry McConnell called suggestions that he wanted Russia to interfere again in 2020 modern-day McCarthyism. What the editorial said. Republicans have issued an all-but-open invitation to foreign attacks on the next presidential election, said the San Francisco Chronicle. McConnell says the many election security bills he blocked were partisan legislation designed to help Democrats. But that's nonsense. One of the bills would have spent $600 million to upgrade voting machines to leave a verifiable paper trail, a security measure against hacked vote totals. McConnell also killed a bill requiring campaigns to notify authorities if foreign nationals contact them. These maneuvers suggest Trump and McConnell are not above any means of retaining power, even the assistance of the nation's enemies. McConnell isn't a toady for Russia, said the Wall Street Journal. The Senate Majority Leader has long opposed efforts to nationalize election rules that have been historically managed by the states. And he's right. A national system would be easier to hack than the systems of 50 states. The Senate under McConnell provided states with additional $380 million in election security funds just last year. What the columnist said. Ratcliffe is a dangerous pick, said Garrett Graff in Wired.com. Unlike previous directors, Ratcliffe has virtually no national security experience. He has boasted that he puts terrorists in prison during his brief stint as a U.S. attorney in the Bush administration, but that's a dramatic exaggeration. He was asked to review the causes of a mistrial in a single terrorism-related case. He's also a conspiracy monger, adopting the debunked rumor that the FBI had a secret society to bring down Trump. The prospect of Ratcliffe standing guard against Russian interference should terrify Americans. Relax, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. The DNI is a notoriously weak position. In theory, they set the budget priorities for the intelligence community. In practice, they have no power to dictate to other agencies. Without experience in the national security state, persuading subordinate agencies is near impossible. So even if Ratcliffe turns out to be the lickspittle that critics fear, he'll have little impact on our counterintelligence efforts. McConnell is a far greater threat, said Dana Milbach in the Washington Post. Indeed, he behaves like a Russian asset. He has blocked bipartisan bills requiring internet companies to disclose who pays for political ads and to impose sanctions on anyone who attacks our elections. During the 2016 campaign, President Obama asked him to issue a joint statement on Russian interference, and McConnell refused, questioning the validity of the intelligence. A leader who won't protect our country from attack is no patriot. We will read the second main story today. It's titled Moderates versus Progressives in Democratic Debate, What Happened. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren fought off a spirited assault upon progressive policy proposals such as Medicare for All during the first round of the second Democratic presidential debates this week. As moderate rivals cast them as peddling unrealistic far-left ideas that will only help President Donald Trump win re-election. The second round of the debate, featuring another 10 candidates, was due to take place after the week went to press. On stage in Detroit, Montana Governor Steve Bullock bemoaned candidates offering wish list economics, while former Maryland Representative John Delaney warned that Medicare for All, which would phase out private insurance, would turn off independent voters. Former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper cautioned that if Democrats embrace the Green New Deal, a sweeping progressive plan to fight climate change, we might as well FedEx the election to Donald Trump. Sanders and Warren, who placed second and third in polls, acted almost in partnership in parrying the attacks. Sanders said grand proposals such as canceling student debt would energize young Americans who might otherwise not vote. Warren castigated her moderate rivals for lacking ambition. I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president, said the Massachusetts senator, just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for. Amid the ideological tussle, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg sought to position himself as a compromise candidate, championing a Medicare for All Who Want It policy that would offer a public plan that competed with private insurers. What the columnist said. Centrists have spotted an opening, said Jonathan Chaitin, NYMag.com. Following former Vice President Joe Biden's stumbles in the first debate, candidates such as Delaney, Bullock, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, all of whom are polling at less than 1%, are hoping to grab a big chunk of the moderate voters the front runner has had to himself. But they'll never do that simply by slamming their left-leaning rivals' plans. They also have to offer up some ideas of their own. The debate has laid bare the divide in the party over how best to defeat Trump, said Kristen Soltis Anderson in WashingtonExaminer.com. Either go with a strongly liberal and disruptive agenda or with a more pragmatic if timid approach. But for all their talk of being bold, Warren and Sanders repeatedly dodged tough questions over just how much their policies will cost and how much they will require average people to change their way of life. That isn't bold or brave at all. A note of interpretive caution, said John Harris in Politico.com. As much as the first round of debates in Miami left an exaggerated impression of the party's leftward drift, people should be wary of viewing Detroit as an equally abrupt lurch to the center. Even avowed centrists such as Delaney talked about hiking taxes on the rich to support liberal policies, while Klobuchar, among others, argued in favor of tighter gun controls. The inevitable conclusion, Democrats as a party are becoming more progressive and aggressive, even if they are zigzagging a bit along the path. Before we leave this page, I'm going to read a short piece from the It Wasn't All Bad section. One-year-old Joseph Tidd loves soccer, and he has a special connection with his favorite player. Like Joseph, Orlando Pride defender Carson Pickett, age 25, was born with a partially formed left arm without a hand. The two first met in April and quickly bonded, playing peekaboo by pulling their shirt sleeves over their arms. They were best friends after that, says Mom Colleen. Joseph and his parents are now regulars at Pride games, and a photo of a delighted Joseph arm bumping with Pickett recently went viral online. Such moments, says Tidd, show Joseph that he's no different than anyone else. He's going to be able to accomplish it all. Time for our controversy of the week, titled Baltimore, Why Trump Called It Disgusting and Infested. Guess who just spent 3 days sending a torrent of angry racist tweets, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com. Yes, that's right. It was the President of the United States. Reportedly upset by Representative Elijah Cummings' strong criticism of how people are being treated at border detention facilities, President Trump this weekend targeted the 68-year-old African-American chairman of the House Oversight Committee with a racially charged salvo of alternately bigoted, hostile, and inaccurate insults. Cummings himself is a racist, Trump tweeted without explanation. And his majority black Maryland district, which includes Baltimore, is a disgusting, rat and rodent-infested mess where no human being would want to live. Human beings obviously do live in Baltimore, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. But rendering non-white people as subhuman is a favorite trope of our blatantly racist president. Before and after he was elected, Trump has repeatedly used the degrading adjective infested to describe places where black and brown people live. As with his call for four non-white U.S. congresswomen, three of them U.S.-born, to go back to their crime-infested countries of origin, Trump's rant against the disgusting city of Baltimore reveals how deeply and sincerely white supremacy is fused to his sense of the world. If acknowledging Baltimore's poverty and chaos makes one a racist, then President Trump has plenty of company, said Seth Barron in the New York Post. In a piece this March titled The Tragedy of Baltimore, the New York Times indicted the city, which boasts the highest homicide and overall crime rates in the U.S., for a failure of order and governance, the likes of which few American cities have seen. In 2015, Senator Bernie Sanders toured Cummings' district and commented, "You would think that you were in a third world country." As for the supposedly telltale word infested, Cummings himself in 1999 described his own district as drug-infested. Are all these people racist, or are they all, including Trump, simply right about Baltimore? Oh, please, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Trump's visceral association of African Americans with crime and filth isn't limited to Baltimore. It dates back to his real estate days when denying apartments to blacks was the basis of the Trump business model. More recently, as Michael Cohen testified before Congress, Trump, while driving through Chicago, remarked that Only the blacks could live like this. For the first time, we have a U.S. president who routinely enjoys disparaging parts of his own country as disgusting hellholes. Trump is not even trying to be everyone's president, said Zachary Wolf and CNN.com. Trump's whole strategy for 2020 is to use race to divide the country and hope angry whites turn out in sufficient numbers to reelect him. It overly flatters Trump to assume his embrace of overt racism is part of some grand political strategy, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. More likely, it's a howl of naked fear from a president who sees himself badly trailing Democrat Joe Biden in the 2020 polls. He is also unnerved by continuing efforts by House Democrats to get his tax returns and records of foreign business relationships. He has reason to be very afraid. Baltimore does have its problems, including rodents, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. But at the risk of stooping to his level, we'd say this to the most dishonest, most immoral, and most incompetent man ever to occupy the Oval Office. Better to have a few vermin living in your neighborhood than to be one. It was a good week for Earthlings. After a large, previously undetected city killer asteroid hurtled past the Earth at 54,000 miles per hour, missing the planet by only 45,000 miles, less than a fifth of the distance to the moon. Sooner or later, there will be one with our name on it, said Alan Duffy, lead scientist at the Royal Institution of Australia. It was a good week for chillin' with the launch Snowballs, a scientifically backed, patent-pending pair of freezable underwear designed to keep male genitalia cool, comfortable, and fertile during the hotter months of the year. Kept area cool when needed, said one satisfied reviewer. It was a good week for rehabilitation after a British judge sentenced a man who had broken his ex-partner's window to 50 minutes in jail, believed to be the shortest sentence in British history. I am truly sorry for my actions, a reformed Shane Jenkins, 23, wrote during his incarceration. But it was a bad week for onophiles after President Trump threatened to put tariffs on French wine and declared, American wine is better than French wine. A teetotaler, Trump later said, I just like the way they look. It was a bad week for automation, with an inspector general's report that a supposedly self-cleaning toilet in the Washington, D.C. metro system required more than $500,000 maintenance over 14 years, and nonetheless has been out of service since the fall of 2017. Finally, it was a bad week for privacy, after research revealed people ages 18 to 22 to be the masters of sexting, with nearly 40% admitting to having sent naked or semi-naked pictures of themselves to another person. A modest but still impressive 3% of people over 74, in what Tom Brokaw calls the greatest generation, also admit to sexting. And here's a short piece before we move on. Supreme Court accepts wall construction. The Supreme Court authorized the Trump administration last week to use $2.5 billion in defense funds to rebuild fences on the U.S.-Mexico border while litigation over the spending is ongoing. In a 5-4 decision, the court's conservative justices reversed lower court orders to freeze construction in Arizona, California, and New Mexico. In response, the American Civil Liberties Union, which represents one set of plaintiffs, said it would seek an expedited hearing before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Trump declared victory on Twitter after the Supreme Court decision. The legal battle is not finished, but in a one-paragraph ruling, conservative justices appeared skeptical of lawmakers and advocates standing to challenge the spending and hinted they would side with the Trump administration. We're on to the briefing page. The title this week is Living on the Streets. West Coast cities have booming economies, but neighborhoods that are filled with homeless people. Why? How bad is it? A tragic paradox is on display in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Their economies are vibrant, and legions of wealthy young professionals spend small fortunes on food, cars, and other consumer goods. Yet in some neighborhoods, people live as if in third world slums. In L.A., tent cities line freeway underpasses. Armies of rats stoke fears of disease, and thousands of homeless people share a dozen toilets. In San Francisco, drug needles and garbage line the streets, and the city employs 4 full-time workers to sweep up feces. Throughout the nation, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the homeless population has been relatively stable in recent years, with about 550,000 Americans living without homes. California accounts for 12% of the U.S. population, but a quarter of it's homeless, and it's getting worse. Los Angeles County's homeless population jumped 12% this year to nearly 59,000, while San Francisco's homeless count grew 17% over the past 2 years to about 8,000, nearly 1% of the city's population. What's driving the problem? Homelessness is a complex phenomenon with many causes, including mental illness and drug addiction. But the primary factor in California is the skyrocketing cost of housing. Over the past 6 years in L.A., the median household income grew 23%, while the median rent increased 67%. And Angelino must earn $47.52 an hour, more than triple the minimum wage, to afford the average monthly rent of $2,471. As a result, one-third of renters qualify as severely rent-burdened, meaning they spend at least half of their income on housing. In those circumstances, an unexpected cost or job loss can quickly result in people failing to pay the rent and landing on the street. For every 2% increase in L.A. rent, 4,227 people are likely to become homeless, according to the real estate database Zillow. In Oakland, one of the Bay Area's most rapidly gentrifying cities, homelessness has exploded by 47% since 2017. Across the bridge in San Francisco, the median one-bedroom apartment now rents for $3,690 per month. Are there other factors? The city's temperate climates make it possible for people to live outdoors. Spending nights on the street can be nearly impossible during New York City's cold winters, which helps explain why just 5% of the city's homeless population is unsheltered. The Big Apple houses more than 61,000 people every night in about 745 shelters. 75% of LA's homeless are unsheltered, as are about 70% in San Francisco. San Francisco recently designated a city-owned parking lot for people living out of vans and RVs, allowing them to stay in this triage lot for up to 90 days. In 2007, Los Angeles officials agreed to stop enforcing an ordinance banning sleeping on the sidewalk. That allowed as many as 10,000 people to live in the 50-block district known as Skid Row, a dystopian encampment where assaults and robberies run rampant. What is the impact of drug use? Drug abuse can be either a cause or a consequence of homelessness. Some people lose jobs and homes because of addiction, while others land on the street first and become drug abusers to blot out the shame and misery of their lives. That's why dealers brazenly target homeless encampments. In Seattle, city officials say the majority of homeless people are hooked on opioids, Among the unsheltered, 80% are believed to have a substance abuse disorder. In Los Angeles, some homeless people smoke crystal meth to stay awake at night so they can fend off thieves and assailants. San Francisco employs a crew to pick up used syringes 12 hours a day, collecting more than $140,000 the past year. What can be done? Municipalities already are spending a lot of money on the problem. Private and public organizations in the Seattle metro area spend $1 billion each year fighting homelessness, nearly $88,000 for every homeless person. Last year, Los Angeles spent $619 million to bring 20,000 people off the streets, largely thanks to a sales tax passed in 2017. A year earlier, LA voters overwhelmingly approved raising property taxes to generate $1.2 billion for 10,000 new housing units. Willingness to spend, however, is half the battle. Building low-income housing always generates powerful, not-in-my-backyard opposition among existing homeowners who fear it will hurt their property values. But without many more affordable apartments, homelessness can't be reduced. Housing is an inescapable, unavoidable part of the solution, said University of California, San Francisco professor Dr. Margot Kuschel, one of the nation's top experts on homelessness. She says that is no less true for people with substance abuse or mental health problems. It makes treatment so difficult, bordering on impossible, if people are living on the street. We'll move now into some of the best columns, starting with two from the U.S. Our first is titled, Sanders, Socialist Hypocrisy. Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign is colliding with socialist reality, said Mark Thiessen. Earlier this year, Sanders proudly announced that his campaign would be the first in history to have a unionized workforce. But he is now facing a labor revolt. Sanders' field organizers working 60 hours per week are protesting that their annual salary of $36,000 works out to $13 an hour, well below the $15 national minimum wage championed by the campaign. The Sanders campaign pushed back, arguing that its wages and benefits are competitive with other campaigns. But McDonald's and Walmart also offer wages and benefits similar to their competitors. That hasn't stopped Sanders from demanding they pay higher wages. After being publicly embarrassed, the campaign agreed to raise salaries to $42,000, pay full premiums for health care coverage, and cap hours at $50 per week. But why should Sanders stop there? He has promised Americans free college tuition, free prescription drugs, and universal child care. If he gave his workers all of that, of course, his campaign would quickly run out of cash. As former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher famously put it, the trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. Should we eliminate mosquitoes? For more than 100 million years, the mosquito has been our apex predator, the deadliest hunter of human beings on the planet, said Timothy Weingard. About 100 trillion of these blood-sucking insects patrol our world, transmitting diseases that kill 700,000 people every year. By infecting human beings with yellow fever, malaria, and a host of other parasites, viruses, and bacteria, mosquitoes may have killed nearly half of the 108 billion humans who have ever lived. Now the life and death battle between mosquitoes and people may be coming to a head. Scientists armed with a gene editing technology called CRISPR have designed mosquitoes that produce infertile offspring. If released in mass into the wild, these biologically altered bugs could render mosquitoes extinct. Limited field experiments have shown this strategy actually works. There is fear, however, that eradicating mosquitoes could have unforeseen consequences, allowing some other species to become a threat or otherwise disturbing Mother Nature's equilibrium. Still, with both old and new pathogens like Zika spreading, it would be a mistake to underestimate the deadly threat mosquitoes pose to our species. At some point, we may have to choose between us and them. This comes from the United Kingdom. We're living a Hitchcockian nightmare. Vicious seagulls are terrorizing people across Britain, said Alan Amos. The decline of fishing industry has left less food for these feathered menaces to scavenge from the docks. So tens of thousands of gulls have forsaken the coast to take up residence in inland towns. And they aren't just poking through dumpsters. These huge flying rats have been dive-bombing families, biting toddlers, and carrying away yelping dogs in their beaks. As a city councillor in Worcester, fully 80 miles from the sea, I am inundated with frightened parishioners telling tales of aggressive birds pecking at them whenever they venture into the garden. Some elderly people are trapped in their homes. These beasts can grow as large as dogs, and they turn positively warlike when anyone gets too close to their chicks. And woe to the cafe patron who dares to eat outside. There is but one way for Britons to take back their homes and streets. We must kill the bloody things. We are an animal-loving nation, and many will balk at violence. But we are the victims here. Gulls pecked Little Roo, a Yorkie, to death in 2015, and last week they carried off Gizmo, a Chihuahua. If we don't start culling these beasts, it won't be long before a baby becomes the next victim. And this from Canada. Will populism take root here, too? Trump-style nationalism is coming to Canada, said Megan Campbell. Maxime Bernier of the right-wing People's Party of Canada has unveiled a campaign platform for the October parliamentary elections, studded with proposals to put Canadians first. Bernier has promised to build a fence along the border with the U.S. to keep out illegal immigrants. He pledges to slash the intake of legal immigrants and refugees to some 150,000 a year, far below the 350,000 target of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's ruling Liberal Party. Bernier says he will also outlaw what he calls birth tourism, in which pregnant foreigners give birth in Canada to secure their child's citizenship, and require aspiring immigrants to submit to in-person interviews to assess the extent to which they align with Canadian values. Bernier is quick to say that his agenda isn't racist. Indeed, he says racists are not welcome in his party. It's just that we cannot be the welfare state of the planet, he insists. Before he revealed his new anti-immigrant proposals this week, Bernier's libertarian-leaning party was polling at 3%. But the new stump speech is bringing shouts of amen and thank you, Maxime. His pitch is the polar opposite of Trudeau's slogan, diversity is our strength. Which one will Canadians embrace? We're moving on to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Laughing at Florida Man. We never tire of gawking at the exploits of America's most shameless and boneheaded hooligan, said journalist Logan Hill in the Washington Post magazine. But real tragedy lies beneath many of their stories. Sporting a buzz cut, prison blues, and a chin strap beard, the slim 24-year-old Floridian Brandon Hatfield leaned sideways in a rolling office chair inside the St. John's County Jail. With a warm southern drawl and a crooked smirk, he says, "I remember half of what happened and half of what didn't." Hatfield finds it hard to separate the fact from fiction of what took place on the night of November 5th, 2018, for a few reasons. That night at a Best Western not far from Fountain of Youth theme park in St. Augustine, Florida, America's oldest city, he was drinking Jack Daniels. He's sure the whiskey led to smoking weed, but he's not clear on how that led to fentanyl, ecstasy, and whatever else ended up in his toxicology report. He remembers the rest of the night in blackout splatches, which have since mixed with the stories he's heard about himself, how he jumped into a crocodile pool at a local zoological park after hours, got bit by an American crocodile, and barely escaped with his life. But it's not his croc shoes, which were found floating in the water the next day. Next thing he knew, he was waking up at the hospital, shackled to a bed with my foot gnawed off. Another reason Hatfield finds it hard to separate the half of what happened from the half of what didn't, when he woke up, he wasn't himself anymore. Much as an arachnid bite changed Peter Parker into Spider-Man, that crocodile chomp transformed Brandon Hatfield into Florida Man. His tale was being retweeted around the world. Florida man wearing Crocs gets bitten after jumping into crocodile exhibit at Alligator Farm. Since Florida Man was first defined on Twitter in 2013 as the world's worst superhero, many men, and it's almost always men, have assumed the mantle. He is a man of a thousand tattooed faces, a slapstick outlaw, an internet traffic gold mine, a cruel punchline, a beloved prankster, a human tragedy, and like some other love-hate American mascots, the subject of burgeoning controversy. Most memes, from planking to Tide Pods, fizzle fast. Florida Man has only grown stronger. There are so many stories about men like Hatfield that a Florida Man challenge went viral this March, in which millions of people Googled their birth dates and Florida Man, finding a near endless list of real news headlines for all 365 days of the year. Florida Man steals $300 worth of sex toys while dressed as a ninja. Florida Man tries to pick up prostitute while driving special needs school bus. Florida Man drinks goat blood in ritual sacrifice, runs for Senate. At its most comical, the Florida Man phenomenon encapsulates the wildness of both America and the internet. At its most salacious, it's a social media update on the true crime TV of America's dumbest criminals. At its most insensitive, Florida Man profits by punching down at the homeless, drug addicted, or mentally ill. I have laughed at headlines like Florida Man arrested for calling 911 after his cat was denied entry into a strip club. I've gawked at stories like Florida Man removes facial tattoos with welding grinder. But over the years, I've also started to get a queasy feeling of complicity when I click on headlines that play up the quirks of horrific crimes for web traffic. This past April, I set out to meet a few Florida men behind the clickbait and answer some questions such as, is Florida Man a hero, a villain, or a victim? The biggest question I get is, what were you thinking? Hatfield continues from his seat inside the St. John's County Jail. Every time my answer is, I wasn't. Hatfield is telling his entire Florida Man story for the first time, and in much more detail than thousands of versions told without his input. The details matter. Take the two croc-like shoes found floating in a crocodile enclosure, which prompted jokes and led the zookeeper to suspect a prank. Hatfield is, on this April afternoon, wearing the same style on his scarred left foot, the one the crocodile attacked. 5 months and six surgeries later, doctors have barely managed to save it. The pair of shoes found floating in the park had also been issued to him in jail after his first drug conviction at age 23. On Instagram, Hatfield has claimed to be a descendant of Devil Ans Hatfield, the wildcat outlaw who sparked the Hatfield-McCoy feud. Rebelliousness, he bragged, is in his blood. When Hatfield was 10, he says he captured a rattlesnake and hid it in an aquarium in his bedroom until it killed his pet boa constrictor and terrified his mother, a nurse. After that, his amused stepdad stuffed the rattler so we'd always remember, Hatfield says. From then on, Hatfield bounced between his divorced parents' homes. On November 2, 2018, Hatfield was convicted of grand theft auto and possession of a Schedule II substance. He tells a convoluted story about how the car was his own and the methamphetamine was his girlfriend's. The judge sentenced him to 2 years of parole. When Hatfield showed up for his first parole appointment, he panicked, certain that if he went inside, he'd be sent to state prison, since he'd already violated parole by leaving the county. Wearing his jail Crocs, Hatfield sneaked out to the parking lot and called some friends, figuring, if I'm going to prison, I'm going to do it big for the weekend and then turn myself in. A few days later, well into his bender at the Best Western Bayfront Hotel, Hatfield boasted to friends about how he grew up wrangling alligators from one pond to another on his papa's land to balance the ecosystem. Nobody believed him. I said, I'll catch an alligator right now. My friend said, I know a perfect place. The friends drove 2 miles to the St. Augustine Alligator Farm Zoological Park, the world's only home to all 24 crocodilian species, with a main pen holding 210 alligators. News channels and sites told Hatfield's story through video clips stitched together from 4 hours of night vision security cam footage, in which he is the zoo's acrobatic attraction. Florida man in his native ersatz habitat. He climbs onto a corrugated metal rooftop about 12 feet above a shallow pool occupied by large American crocodiles. He leaps in and thrashes as he's bit. But what most news videos missed is that Hatfield escaped unscathed after his first jump. Then he jumped back in, turning himself into literal clickbait. The whole thing was, I dropped my phone inside the pit, he says, a brand new iPhone. That's whenever he death rolled me. It de-sleeved the bottom of my foot until it looked like a chicken breast. I'd wiggle my toes and you could see my tendons move. On crutches at his first court appearance, he heard the bailiffs and other cracking jokes and calling him Crocodile Dundee, says his defense attorney, Jill Barger. She took his case pro bono because she pitied him, and also, I'm not going to lie, she admits, because Florida men get valuable media attention. His new convictions of criminal mischief and trespassing compounded his earlier charges. Judge Howard Maltz, who saw Hatfield on TMZ the night before meeting him in court, sentenced him to 364 days in county jail, plus 2 years of community control. At Hatfield's sentencing, Maltz told him, you should not be alive. God has a plan for you. We may not know what it is, but God has a plan for you. I hear it all the time, Hatfield says with a shrug. Daniel in the lion's den. In the Bible, Daniel was thrown into a den of carnivorous beasts, but found blameless by his God and saved for a higher purpose. Hatfield likes this idea. He says he'll warn Floridians not to follow in his bloody footsteps and become a Florida man like him, because he wishes he'd done the same for his stepbrother, who died of a heroin overdose while Brandon was in jail. He's lost 3 relatives in the past year to drug-related deaths, he says. My little brother, Bo, passed away on heroin at 17. He was probably looking up to me. I went to jail and left him out there by himself. There's nothing funny about this part of Hatfield's viral story. It's the half of what happened in most Florida man stories that doesn't fit in a tweet. The bummer half that has to do with how people end up doing reckless things and what follows viral infamy. We laugh at these stupid things, Maltz tells me in his chambers, but there are tragedies behind many of them. I came to the jail to see how Hatfield ended up in that crocodile pit, but also to ask how the media attention has affected him. I assumed that he would be mortified to go viral on the worst day of his life, but that's not how he saw it. At first I was embarrassed, he says, but I'm prone to do stuff like this anyway. So it was just a matter of time before something blew up. Hatfield talks about his newfound internet notoriety like he's Burr Rabbit, thrown into the digital briar patch where he was born and bred. I was always on the internet. I go live on Facebook. I live on Instagram. Drugs have been Hatfield's escape from the real world, but social media is where he feels most honest. It's the real me. Is it okay to laugh at Florida Man? In the comedy business, the answer to such questions is always an unsatisfying, it depends. The once absurdist Florida Man meme has undoubtedly curdled into callous jokes at the expense of the vulnerable. But plenty of people laugh with Florida Man, knowing how easy it is to become one. Ultimately, many of these stories aren't as extraordinary as the headlines. They just have that one odd detail, or one memorable mugshot that, if spun correctly, might turn one person's DUI into another's LOL. When AA baseball team, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, planned its Florida Man night, it looked for a family-friendly mascot who represented the best of Florida Man without dragging along the worst of his baggage. A Floridian who hadn't hurt anyone, who wasn't being exploited, and who was happy to have people laugh along with him. They found Lane Pittman, a multiple-time Florida Man who rallies the crowd at Jacksonville Jaguar NFL games, waving flags and firing T-shirt cannons as part of the Jack's Pack hype team. At the Jumbo Shrimp's Florida Man night, Pittman will play the national anthem on electric guitar because the first time he went viral, he was Florida Man arrested after playing national anthem on July 4th. In the video seen everywhere from BuzzFeed.com to Fox News, Pittman, wearing jorts and an American flag tank top, shreds like Hendrix on Neptune Beach sidewalk until hundreds of people gather around and he is arrested for obstructing traffic. I was like, this is American as crap. Freedom, baby, Pittman reminisces. I had everybody dabbing me up, high-fiving me. I had one old lady kiss me on the face. Then two cops came over. The second time he went viral, he uploaded a 9-second video of himself, no shirt, no shoes, just board shorts, headbanging and holding an American flag against the torrential wind and rain of 2016's Hurricane Matthew, to the blare of Slayer's Raining Blood. The video was viewed nearly 4 million times. When I meet Pittman at a Hard Rock music festival in downtown Jacksonville, the lean 26-year-old surfer dude with long hair is again wearing jorts and an American flag tank top, what he calls my Hurricane Lane persona. Amid the roar of speed metal, Pittman hypes up fans at a pop-up advertising space where autograph seekers wait on members of Korn and Evanescence. Pittman's hurricane videos have become a hurricane season YouTube ritual, a rain dance in defiance of the weather. In some ways, the original video is, like frozen Florida orange juice, the most concentrated and syrupy example of what it means to be a Florida man. A wild man who stands firm against propriety, the forces that threaten to destroy this strange paradise, and common sense itself. People throw shade at Florida, like a lot, says Pittman. A brief cloud passes over his upbeat mood. Then the Florida man smiles. But you can't put shade on us. We're the Sunshine State. This was excerpted from a story that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And it looks like we may have time for a couple of articles on the Talking Points page. We'll start with food stamps, cutting 3 million recipients. The Trump administration is kicking 3.1 million people off food stamps, said Dylan Matthews in Vox.com. Since House Democrats wouldn't approve the cuts, the White House is altering a rule that helps needy people receive benefits from the program more easily and quickly. Currently, those who apply for other forms of public assistance can be automatically enrolled in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. This policy has enabled states to provide food stamps to people who have more than the federal limits of $2,250 to $3,500 in savings. Advocates say many of the working poor suffer from food insecurity despite having jobs and some savings. Not knowing if they'll be able to eat breakfast or dinner results in chronic stress and illness that winds up costing taxpayers more in the end than SNAP would. The rule change is common sense, not cruelty, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In theory, the practice of cross-eligibility was a good idea intended to trim administrative hassle and avoid repeating eligibility tests for welfare applicants. In practice, it has allowed states greedy for federal dollars to do end runs around the rules and keep as many people as possible on the dole, regardless of need. In some cases, officials counted passing out a brochure or calling a toll-free hotline number for child care or transportation assistance as tantamount to the applicants receiving benefits, thus cross-qualifying them for food stamps as well. The closure of this loophole would prevent a blatant abuse of public resources and save taxpayers $9.4 billion over 5 years. The charge of widespread abuse is a lie, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. The Congressional Research Service has found that SNAP's fraud rate is only 0.57%. The Republican myth about underserving food stamp freeloaders is largely based on a stunt by Minnesota millionaire Rob Undersander, who collected about $5,300 over 19 months in SNAP benefits to make a point. But the only thing Undersander proved is that a determined individual can commit fraud on the U.S. government. That's not news. There is a perverse irony in Trump's SNAP cut, said David Super in the New York Times. The money saved will help offset a nearly $2 trillion tax cut for corporations and the rich. Once again, the burden of paying for the profligacy of our elected leaders falls on those least able to afford it. Death penalty. Why Barr wants executions. Anyone who has witnessed the steady rise of Trump with the thumbs up, thumbs down swagger of an omnipotent Roman emperor knew this day was coming, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Attorney General William Barr announced last week that the Justice Department has canceled an unofficial 16-year-long moratorium on executing federal prisoners and will put five inmates to death in December and January. To proactively defend against charges of racial discrimination, Barr selected carefully. Three of the five inmates are white, and all murdered minors. But that doesn't change the fact that capital punishment has been proved to be racially discriminatory and can lead to the innocent being executed. In recent decades, 156 death row inmates have been exonerated by DNA testing or other evidence. So why bring back executions now? As is so often the case with our Caligula-like president, the cruelty is the point. It thrills his base. There is nothing wrong with executing the worst of the worst, said criminal law professor Robert Blecker in FoxNews.com. As Barr pointed out, Congress passed legislation to reinstate the federal death penalty in 1988, and it was signed by the president. Yet only three people have been executed since then, and none since 2003. We owe it to the victims and their families to carry forward the sentence imposed by our justice system, Barr said. Some people commit crimes so awful that, as a society, we have an obligation to kill them. Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh was executed in 2001 for setting a bomb that killed 168 people including children at a daycare center. Did he not deserve to die? How about Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who placed a bomb next to a child at the finish line of the Boston Marathon? He deserves to die too. Barr's order to resume executions will probably be delayed, said Garrett Epps in TheAtlantic.com. For one, the government may not be able to obtain the pentobarbital sodium it says it will use to conduct the executions. The largest manufacturer of the drug banned its sale for capital punishment 8 years ago. And federal defender offices will provide the condemned with vigorous appeals that could go on for months. A delay won't trouble Barr, said Andrew Cohen in RollingStone.com. What he and Trump want is a death penalty debate during the 2020 elections to distract everyone from the administration's malfeasance and the president's own legal troubles. And I think we can squeeze in one short note. 16-year-old Kyle Giersdorf of Pennsylvania took home $3 million in prize money for winning the first ever Fortnite World Cup over 99 other top-ranked players of the popular shooter survival video games. The tournament was held live in the packed Arthur Ashe Tennis Stadium in New York City, with more than 1 million people watching it online. And we'll finish with a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who says, "A little rebellion now and then is a good thing, and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical." And that is it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138.